Well, hello, everyone. Again, something a little bit different today. I have a guest, Caleb Maupin. And earlier in the week, I did an interview with Todd, who I believe you've met before, Praise of Folly, where we talked about what's gone wrong on the online right, the populist right, the dissident right. And today, I want to have a look at the other side. I want to have a look at what's gone wrong with the modern left. What is the modern left? Is the modern left actually the real left? If it's not, what happened to the real left? All of these sorts of questions, because I've started reading my Marxism again. I've got stacks of books here on Althusser and the Stalinist economy and so on. And in this journey, I came across the work of Caleb here, and he's actually written lots of really fascinating books. This one, as someone who's written lots of stuff on elite theory, What is a Counter Gang was really interesting, and we'll talk more about that in a second. But he's got lots. I mean, I think this is one of the latest ones, isn't it? Divisions in the Ruling Class, Trotsky and the Neoconservatives. One of the true villains of 20th century history is Trotsky, if you ask me. The Battle for Soviet History and Why It Matters, Khrushchevism, and many other books. This is like just scratching the surface. So why don't we start with that question then? The modern left, by which I mean the kind of abomination that we've come to know, the woke, right, the Rainbow Coalition, Antifa and BLM, you know, all of this stuff that we've seen over the past 10 years, is that the real left? Or if it's not, what is the real left and what happened to it?
Well, my understanding of where the entity that we now call woke came from is that it was a three-stage process. That coming out of World War II, you had the global communist movement, the communist parties that had trade unions and, you know, millions of people aligned with them. In the United States, they were crushed with McCarthyism. And during McCarthyism, the CIA launched a program called the Congress for Cultural Freedom. And that program was where they began funneling money to leftists, academics, college professors, artists, and others. And the idea was to kind of promote leftists who were against communism and against the official, you know, Soviet aligned communism. But it was about a lot more than that. They were kind of reinventing the aesthetics of leftism. This is when they funded Jackson Pollock's paintings, right? They thought social realism, which was the artistic style that, you know, the murals of Diego Rivera, John Steinbeck and the Grapes of Wrath, they didn't like that. They thought it was totalitarian. So they started funding, you know, the work of Jackson Pollock, who just splatters paint on a canvas, and they started funding all kinds of art that was art that didn't have real shapes and was just kind of a celebration of disorganization and confusion. And they were not just pushing an anti-Soviet brand of politics, they were also changing something psychological. And you know, you have the rise of Susan Sontag, Notes on Camp, and they were kind of changing, you know, what leftism meant as the CIA was subsidizing all these leftist artists to try and nudge left-wing circles to be anti-communist. And that was the first stage, was the Congress for Cultural Freedom, which gave birth to the new left. Then from there, in the 70s and 80s, they discovered that these new left entities were very good at destabilizing countries. And the color revolution apparatus was dispatched around the world. And that's where George Soros, you know, is funding these art galleries. And they go to communist countries and they find kind of the most privileged people, the children of the party elite. And they give them the fantasy that they can have modern capitalism and they can drink Coca-Cola and shop at Walmart and all of that, but they have to help overthrow their government. And the color revolutions of 1989 are largely carried out by people who don't, you know, say they don't like capitalism, but they also don't like Stalinism or whatever. They're for freedom and a people's movement from below. And the counterculture left kind of recruits a lot of the party elite, the children of the party elite and others, and the color revolution model of overthrowing a country, that's phase two. And then I would argue that after the 2008 financial meltdown, this apparatus that was originally created to kind of counter communism in the West was dispatched to carry out the color revolutions abroad. They were brought back to the United States, and they came home with the Obama administration. as a mechanism of trying to stabilize the United States amid the financial crisis and build kind of a cadre, a layer of people that could be the enforcers of economic policies of degrowth to stabilize capitalism. And that's what we're seeing now, is that there's a layer of people that have been radicalized and cultivated by the CIA to believe in something that has nothing to do with Marxism or what the Soviet communist movement was about. And largely it's about, you know, anti-human, like kind of Malthusianism, the idea there's too many people in the world, we need to drive down consumption, drive down the population. There's been a layer created, an army created to try and force that onto the Western world, to stabilize the Western system. And that's what woke is, BLM, the anti-Trump movement, all of that. And I was part of Occupy Wall Street, and I could see that Occupy Wall Street was very much engineered from below. But, you know, I maneuvered within it to try and get something good done. And I've paid a lot of attention to this. And there's a lot of big foundations and a lot of wealthy, you know, forces that kind of fund what you might call leftism and are using it to try and stabilize capitalism. And it's very closely tied in with the global effort to destabilize and overthrow governments. I hear people in conservative circles often say George Soros is a communist, and it's like George Soros has toppled more communist governments than anybody else. But then I hear leftists, if you bring up George Soros, they say, oh, you're spreading right-wing conspiracy theories, you're anti-Semitic. Well, no, there is reality here. And this entity, this woke left, that is very much an incarnation of leftist aesthetics more than anything. And, you know, the Trotskyite drive for permanent revolution, that entity is very, very dangerous. And you'll notice that it's something that the countries around the world that are resisting the Western system are also very, very opposed to. So, it's a very interesting way things have developed.
As you were talking, one of the most mind-blowing books I've ever read, which I don't know if you're familiar with it, it's called Who Paid the Piper? Piper? And one of the reasons it was so mind-blowing is because that book reveals that one of the masterminds behind the CIA project that you're talking about was literally James Burnham, who was a former Trotskyist, but also one of the key elite theorists, or one of the key purveyors of elite theory, which I've written books on, but also someone who had contempt for democracy and contempt for liberalism in his own writings, and yet he is involved in creating essentially a non-communist fake left that is amenable to the American establishment, while at the same time, because you mentioned McCarthyism, basically providing the materials for the John Birch Society, for example, and various other kind of quote-unquote cranks on the right. All the receipts were in a book written by James Burnham, which I saw. I actually had to buy it on an eBay auction. It's called The Web of Subversion, published in the 50s, where James Burnham provides all of the evidence for the Reds under the bed, the communists, and so on. Very interesting. So they had this, it's like a pincer movement where you end up essentially with William F. Buckley as a fake right, and then this thing that you're describing, the new left, I guess, on the left. And then the trajectory goes, you know, As you described it. I just find it really kind of, you know, because they talk about the paranoid style of American politics, but this is like the paranoid style of government. It's like they leave nothing to chance. It is really quite totalitarian in its own way, because they don't allow anything. One of the questions I've got for you, you mentioned Occupy and woke. One of the things I've noticed that happened, like certainly this has happened with MAGA as one example. In MAGA, you've got people who've been there from the start. You've got true patriots. You've got, you know, people who just love Trump, obviously. But then you've got people who, you know, have a kind of a set of convictions, what they want for America, bringing manufacturing back and all of this sort of stuff. Maybe Steve Bannon would be one example, although there are question marks about him. But over time, and it's actually playing out in a very public way at the moment, what happened there is that simply those true blue people were actually just displaced, like actually physically displaced by Zionists in this case, okay, by system stooges. So they call it crowding out. Did that happen in the Occupy movement? Did it happen in the left-wing space where you actually had Marxists and communists and so on, and they were just muscled out by this new kind of rainbow coalition of people, or in some cases, were they the same people who turned?
Well, you know, at the time of Occupy Wall Street, if you'll remember, a couple like years before that, you know, the U.S. economy had crashed. And it was clear that some of the elite thought, you know, the communist groups are so weak and they're so irrelevant. Now would be a great time for them to go out and do their thing, to help Obama kind of, you know, pass some regulations on Wall Street, you know, et cetera. And, you know, I think it was Newsweek said we're all socialists now. You know, Michael Moore made this movie, Capitalism, a Love Story. And there was kind of like there was almost a moment where they were like kind of nudging the communist groups. And the communist groups were so weak and ineffective, like the establishment had already determined they weren't a threat in any way. But they didn't realize that they were just incapable of being useful stooges. I mean, they were just completely, and I was there and I attended the U.S. Social Forum in 2007 and then in 2010. And like the ruling class, they were handing out foundation money and all that. And they were hoping the communist groups would do it for them. And they just couldn't do it. And so Occupy Wall Street was kind of take two. And that was, you know, this guy, David Graeber, who had been involved in the anti-globalization protests and was tied in with Soros and all of that. And they brought in a lot of the people from Eastern Europe, people from AUTPOR, which is the like group that they used to bring down Milosevic. It's like their symbol is a fist. And they were like a color revolution to bring down the Serbian government. They brought some of them in, and Occupy from the beginning, it was kind of like the left was so bad. I mean, what was left of the communist groups, they had been just so badly battered by the FBI and just, you know, and decades of defeat and all of that, that they were so bad that the establishment couldn't even use them as foot soldiers. It was kind of tragic. But you know, and I saw that, and that the communist groups were just too weak to be useful. And what is interesting though, is that, you know, starting around the time that the Bernie campaign got going, the Bernie Sanders movement, you know, you started, suddenly there was all this interest in socialism and all of that. Then there was the rise of BreadTube. And that's kind of what made me, you know, infamous on the internet, is I wrote the book BreadTube Serves Imperialism. And I got information about who was directing, you know, the BreadTube circles. And you have all these internet socialists that out of nowhere pop up on the internet. And they have a message that is follow the Democratic Party. And anyone who supports actual anti-imperialist governments is a secret Nazi, and there's this weird witch hunt against Nazbols and secret Nazis, and the memo gets sent out that, oh, if somebody talks like a real leftist, they're probably secretly a Nazi pretending to be a leftist. And, you know, there's this like bizarre witch hunt where these kind of inflated social media voices are out there telling everyone that to be a socialist means that you hate Donald Trump and you're involved in the anti-Trump movement and you have nothing to do with anti-imperialism. And that was very bizarre. And, you know, and so I revealed, it was made apparent to me that the guy directing them, this guy, Dr. Steve Hassan, who is the anti-cult guru, wrote the book The Cult of Trump and was mentored by Robert J. Lifton, one of the top military psychiatrists, and was involved in like kidnapping people during the 70s to get them out of Scientology or whatever, that this guy was directing them. I wrote the book kind of critiquing BreadTube's perspective and pointing out that they were backed by this guy, Steve Hassan. And then out of that, I mean, I didn't even know how right I was. Then Greyzone discovered, you know, receipts that British intelligence was funding Abigail Thorne, and that she was being paid by, you know, British intelligence foundations to do her work. Philosophy Tube, one of the biggest leftist channels, was basically being funded by the British government. Then Hillary Clinton did a whole special with ContraPoints about how much she loves ContraPoints and all of that. And then one of the people that I highlighted in the book, this guy, Caleb Kane, he did an interview and he's trying to say that Caleb's wrong. He says, well, I only met Steve Hassan once. It's actually this whole wing of the FBI called Countering Extremism. That's who trained us. That's who told us to do this. And they basically admit that BreadTube was completely manufactured from above. It was completely an intelligence operation to try and control young people that got into the Bernie movement and try to nudge them, make sure that they didn't become anti-imperialist. And that, you know, I mean, now we're finding out about Destiny, Stephen Bunnell, this guy who I guess was never part of BreadTube, but was the big BreadTube voice, is being paid by Israeli foundations lots of money to debate Candace Owens and debate Norman Finkelstein. And he's pro-Israel and pro-establishment. And I mean, we see that they kind of created an internet left to try and control leftist discourse. And part of that internet left was it's very similar to what the Congress for Cultural Freedom did, is that, you know, it's kind of creating a way that you can be left but not really oppose the establishment, and then waging these kind of cancel culture hate campaigns against genuine anti-imperialist voices. I'll never forget, you know, when, you know, Jimmy Dore was pushing the idea that maybe they should, you know, have a vote on Medicare for all. And his name is, you know, trending on Twitter. And I start reading the tweets and I'm thinking, did this guy murder somebody? Did they reveal that he was, you know, responsible for 9/11 or something? Like, what in the world did Jimmy Dore do? I've never seen this level of hate. All it was that he had said, hey, they should actually use the pandemic opportunity to put up a vote for Medicare for all. And the woke left just tore into Jimmy Dore like you wouldn't believe. Jimmy Dore was Satan. Jimmy Dore was the biggest racist. He was a Nazi pretending to be a communist. I have never seen anything like it. Well, he was actually challenging the establishment, and he had an anti-establishment message, and they had mobilized this kind of internet community of leftists to just go after Jimmy Dore like I've never seen, and that they are very much trying to control the discourse. And I've been reading a lot of counterinsurgency literature, you know, from Frank Kitson. That's the word counter gang comes from Frank Kitson. And he talks about how societies are in like kind of a sliding scale. You have subversion, which is just people opposing the establishment, but then that can lead to what he calls terrorism, which, I mean, that's, I wouldn't use that word the same way, but it means people are exercising power and actually, you know, able to force society to change, mass movements, et cetera. And he argues terrorism can lead to civil war, where the old order kind of collapses and breaks into different camps, and you have, you know, the potential for a new government or a new system to come into being. And so you have to control subversion. And that I believe very clearly what's going on now is a counterintelligence, you know, operation, what you might call a counterinsurgency. They are very much trying to manipulate dissident ideas on the right and the left. And that's very, very clear. I mean, the killing of Charlie Kirk, for example, the way that that was, you know, it was just advertised all over social media, all these leftists that were celebrating it. First of all, if you were a leftist, the memo got sent out. That's what you should do. You should be celebrating the murder of this guy. Also, the right was then traumatized by images of all these people celebrating the murder of this man to put into their mind, you know, look at this, like, this is the left. They want to kill you. They want to kill your family. And they don't want any genuine kind of populist coalition to emerge from below. I've compared it a lot to the years of lead in Italy, Operation Gladio. How, you know, in Italy was getting ready to leave NATO during the 1970s. Public opinion in Italy was against, you know, NATO and wanted independence, was critical of the United States. And the way that Italy was kept in NATO was with Operation Gladio, and that it started out with, you know, fascist groups that were kind of being nudged and backed by the CIA to kill communists. But then it got to the point that then you had the Red Brigades, which were like communist groups that were killing communists and fascists as well. And then you had fascists that were anti-NATO killing other fascists that were pro-NATO. And it got to the point that nobody knew what side anyone was on. And people were dying in you know, shootings, and, you know, something like 400 people were killed overall, but a lot more people were crippled for life by being shot in their legs. And there was so much political violence in Italy. People were just leaving the country. They didn't want to live there anymore. And the public was kind of overruled. And Italy is still a member of NATO. And the public just saw this confusing mess of political violence. They didn't know who was on what side. And so that you couldn't really build a mass movement to leave NATO. And that the most hopeful moment was 1978, where the Communist Party had significant gains in the elections, and the Christian Democrat Party, which was a conservative party, approached the Communist Party and said, let's form a coalition government. And Aldo Moro, who was a conservative, said he would form a coalition government with the communists, and then the Red Brigades kidnapped him, and then shortly after that, he was killed. And it was later revealed the Italian government knew where he was and could have rescued him from the Red Brigades, but they didn't because the CIA wouldn't give them permission. And the journalist who revealed that ended up dead. And that Operation Gladio, it's now widely understood that the manipulation of Italian politics and the making it a confusing mess of political violence, that was the strategy of American intelligence to keep Italy in NATO. And that's what I think they're doing right now. They're trying to foment some kind of years of lead so that all the opposition is so confused and so traumatized. No one knows who's on what side. And they just kind of win by default. I quote William S. Lind, who's also a counterinsurgency strategist. And he talks about, for the last 4,000 years, we've all heard the story of David and Goliath. And everyone sympathizes with David. No one ever sympathizes with Goliath. And the way insurgents and opposition forces win is that they are perceived as David against Goliath, and the population comes over to their side. So if you want to defeat them, what you do is you make it not a fight of David and Goliath. You make it a fight of David versus another David versus another David versus another David, and you can't tell who the real David is, and there's so much confusion. And then Goliath is just standing back and saying, look, I don't want to fight. I don't know what the problem is. And eventually Goliath just kind of wins by default. And that's the strategy that they're employing. They're trying to control the fact that the majority of people in the Western countries, in Britain and the United States, we don't like the way our countries are going. Our living standards are dropping. Our freedoms are being taken away. They're marching us toward World War III, and we don't want it. And we need to form some kind of opposition bloc to deal with it. And they are determined to draw lines in blood and engage in all kinds of manipulations to make sure that no solid block of opposition emerges, so they can just keep us marching toward a low-wage police state and World War III, which is what the overwhelming majority of the population here does not want.
Yeah, so fascinating stuff, and quite a lot of other stuff I want to get into from what you've said there. But you mentioned the bread tube, and I'm not trying to like stir drama here, Caleb, right? But let's just name some names a second, and you can tell me whether they are part of this or not, in your view, okay? So you mentioned Destiny, and you mentioned ContraPoints, okay, and Philosophy Tube. But there are some, I mean, what about Hassan Piker? He's quite a big name at the moment on the left. I mean, he, again, in my mind, strikes me as another one of these sorts of figures. Is he a...
I would say so. Now, he's a more recent development. He wasn't as big back in the day. He's, you know, come out of the blue more recently, but he's definitely, yeah, he's one of the new voices that's being highlighted. He will occasionally say pro-China things, from what I understand. So he doesn't completely have the line that if you're anti-imperialist, you're a Nazi, which was the standard bread tube line. But yeah, he's a more new development, but I would put him in the same category.
Vaush, he's another one.
He's something special. Now, I debated Vaush because I didn't even know who he was. But, you know, Vaush was running this line that if you support North Korea, you're the same as a Nazi. And I pointed out, you know, he says he loves the Black Panthers. They supported North Korea. They sent delegations there. They studied Kim Il-sung's works. Fred Hampton praised Kim Il-sung and they studied it. And it just seems like, I mean, you list all these great people that, you know, that were anti-imperialist, that were aligned with the Soviet Union, like Albert Einstein, you know, I mean, it's like every iconic leftist of the 20s, 30s and 40s was supporting the Soviet Union. But according to him, no, anyone who would admire the Soviet Union, admire North Korea, they're all the same as Hitler. And the pedophile thing is very, very weird. You know, he for years, people were saying there was something up there. And then I guess the smoking gun was when he put, you know, like literal, you know, child pornography on the screen of one of his debates. I mean, it was like drawn child pornography, so it was legal. And it was like on the screen while he was streaming. And everyone's just like, what in the world is going on there? That was just absolutely bizarre. And, you know, who was this guy? I mean, he was just some kind of internet lurker. But then his father worked on The Matrix and was some kind of prominent Hollywood guy. And, you know, just this like weird autistic, you know, basement dweller that they decided to make internet famous, who, you know, and then, you know, who's got this strange, you know, interest in child pornography and pedophilia and stuff. I mean, it's a really, really bizarre case. You know, the Vaush thing is very, very strange. You have to look at that. You almost wonder if Vaush was somebody who they caught doing something illicit with his computer. And then they said to him, you know, hey, we'll make you the famous internet leftist if you follow our orders or something. It was very odd. One thing that I noticed that Vaush did was he would debate right wing voices. You know, that was his big thing, is he would debate conservatives, you know, people that were, you know, critical of mass migration and things like that. And he would treat them with kind of very, very kindly, because he was trying to recruit their audience. He was running some kind of psyop to recruit their audience. But if he ever debated somebody like me, we were evil. We were scum. We were, you know, and it was very odd. And again, that's the whole Steve Hassan thing. It was some kind of, you know, intelligence, you know, like trying to recruit people out of the right. You know, he's very much like a crude stereotype of what they think your typical like right wing quote unquote incel would be. right? You know, a video game playing guy who's autistic, who's rude, mm-hmm. He's a very strange case, and you have to wonder how controlled he is. And you also have to ask the question of, I mean, at this point, I could talk about Vosh all day. It's not really that important though. There's so many of these weirdos they just found. I've been going to socialist and communist gatherings. I would go to Left Forum every year. You know, the communist groups until the rise of the Bernie Sanders campaign, communism and leftism in America was a quite small scene. I never met any of these people, right? It was, you would see people around, you would know people. Never met any of these people, but out of the blue, these people just pop up. They're the voice of communism and socialism on the internet, hundreds of thousands of views, and they don't know basic stuff. Like this guy Thought Slime didn't know what democratic centralism was. He said, well, the idea of having a centrally planned economy, Marx never said that. That's democratic centralism. Well, no, democratic centralism is how you run a political organization, right? I mean, they have no idea what they're talking about, but they're boosted to put out these ideas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, one of the frustrations that I have with the online right, in fact, it's almost an exact mirror of what you're describing, because so much of it then becomes a game of personal dramas. Okay. Yeah. And I mean, you get this at various stages. So there are the big mega ones, like at the minute it's like Candice Owens and Tucker Carlson and so on, but they very often, the story becomes about them, and it's like watching a soap opera, you know?
Yeah.
But even lower down, a lot of the time it becomes about dramas and beefs, and you know, you're not really talking about politics or ideas, or it just becomes about all of this interpersonal crap. And however small a way, I'm just trying to cut across everything at the minute and be like, we're just all trying to figure out what the hell happened in the past 100 years. Why are we all in the shit, and how can we get out of it?
Right. Yeah. No. 100%. The fandoms become less and less political over time, and they just become about worshiping an individual and then hating whoever they're beefing with. And you can see that. And that, you know, it's like people have this this weird relationship with a voice that they listen to, and they're loyal to that voice. And facts and reality don't matter. It's like, this is my friend, this person I've never met, who's this voice in my head I listen to on the internet. I'm loyal to them. And they can say wildly inaccurate things, and you know, and people just, well, this is my friend, this is my voice. But then give it a year or two, then they've moved on to somebody else. And that's the thing, is if politics is just consumption, if politics is just watching a streamer, you know, you don't watch the same TV show for your whole life, right? You eventually change the channel. And that's the thing. There's not real organizing going on. With my organization, the Center for Political Innovation, we're doing real organization to carry out real operations. And a lot of this stuff is just kind of a form of internet entertainment, I guess you will. And eventually people change the channel. And that, we know so many people, you know, they were anarchists first, and then they were communists, and then they were fascists, and then they were Buddhists, and then they were this and they're that. They were never any of those things, because all of those ideologies, those religions, those worldviews were meant for a practice. They were meant to build organizations. This is all, you know, organizational technology, if you want to put it that way, or psychological technology to build organizations. And if you just are consuming it on the internet, you're not really living it, right? And I really liked Lauren Southern had a video about internet religions on the right, and how it's a similar thing, is these people, they go from being Orthodox to being a Muslim to being, you know, and that's not really the essence of any of those things, that these ideologies and these worldviews were made to cultivate a practice, to build a structure, and that if you just kind of consume them in an intellectual way, you're not really understanding what the purpose that these things served.
Yeah, no, I absolutely. In fact, I thought the new Pope actually had a good line on this the other day, where he was saying, like, you know, it's all well and good if you become Catholic on the internet, but you actually go to church, it's not a real thing, you know? And in fact, one of the interesting things, you know, having seen the various scenes, there's someone who's been a Catholic for 4 months arguing with the Pope and things like this. It's like, well, you know what I mean? all right. So in terms of actual ideas then, actual history and some of this stuff we've been talking about, just to try to kind of tie a bow on all of this, where, if people want to actually start to think about what real leftism is and was, where should they start, Caleb, in your view?
Well, I think that the first thing we need to get out there is, you know, we need to get back to the basics of, you know, what is wrong with capitalism, right? Socialism, Utopian and Scientific by Frederick Engels, a very short book that was considered like the essential reading in the Marxist movement for a long time. Just three short essays by Frederick Engels. We published our own edition of it at CPI, and I wrote kind of a lengthy introduction to it. But if you read it, I mean, he starts out by saying capitalism emerged into the world and, you know, it was supposed to create freedom and equality. It didn't. We thought we were getting a just society out of the French Revolution. We have these problems. So these kind of religious movements emerge of people that are trying to do the right thing. From then, he explains the philosophy of dialectical materialism. And then in the final chapter, he says capitalism has this problem that has never existed before in history, which is poverty created by abundance. In the past, when people were homeless, it was just because there wasn't enough housing. When people were hungry, it was there wasn't enough food. But capitalism breaks down on its own because the productivity of society becomes so great that the economy breaks down. It's called glut, G-L-U-T, glut. The poverty created by abundance, the economy breaking down. And like in America, right, the U.S. government buys millions of dollars worth of cheese every year and buries it in a cave in Missouri. Why? To keep the price of cheese high enough and dairy high enough that the farms don't collapse. That doesn't make any logical sense, right? And that the problem with capitalism is that the more productive and efficient technology becomes, the more unemployment and economic instability there is. And these concepts, the problem of overproduction of the value crisis, the tendency of the falling rate of profit, this understanding that capitalism has unleashed human creativity and all of that, but it's gotten to the point that it outstrips the narrow, irrational limits of the profit motive. That was the Marxist understanding, that capitalism is getting in the way of human productivity and that we need a rational central plan to enable human creativity to soar, and that ultimately the highest stage of communism is based on vast abundance. The idea is that with rational centralization of the economy, we can create so much wealth that eventually the need for a government can go away and people can just do what they feel like doing. A post-scarcity society created by rationally overcoming the flaws of the market. Marx talked about the anarchy of production. Now, I'm very thankful that during the 2008 financial crisis, I was in a Marxist group that spent a lot of time digging into Marx and going over why the financial crisis had actually happened. And giving out this understanding, the financial crisis was rooted in the fact that technology has advanced and there's no room for workers at the assembly line anymore. And that then means that there's less spending power and we can't buy back the products we're producing. And the amount of wealth extracted from our labor goes down. And because there's so little labor power being done, there's so little wealth being extracted, the rate of profit is falling. This is the Marxist critique of capitalism. And if you listen to the modern left, that you'll never hear any of this. First of all, they promote the idea of degrowth. Growth is bad. They accept the idea that capitalism just creates endless growth. They just think that's bad. That's not the Marxist critique at all. Marxist critique was that capitalism, the growth eventually leads to an economic meltdown every few years because it can't handle the technological advancement. But the woke left, they think growth is bad. And then their critique is just this basic kind of kindergarten level. Some people work in the factory and get paid wages, and some people own the factory, and that's not fair. And so we're going to build a worker cooperative where they share. That has nothing to do with what they were doing in the Soviet Union. That has nothing to do with what, you know, modern China is. That has nothing to do with any of this. And if that's your understanding, of course, you're going to come out with this bizarre distortion, right? The problem is that the chaos of the market, the irrationality of the market, creates a situation where the more wealth that is produced, the poorer people get, and that you ultimately need a central plan, and that we don't live in regular capitalism. You know, these woke people are always talking about the pencil factory and the work people who work in the pencil factory. We don't live in that world. We live in the world of imperialism, globalism, big, gigantic monopolies that go around the world, dominating economies, grinding countries into poverty. That's what we live in. We live in a world of high-tech imperialism. You know, if people want to really understand the essence of this, you know, you don't have to read Marx, read Edward Bellamy. Edward Bellamy was a socialist in American history, and he wrote a short story called The Parable of the Water Tank. right? And we included it in one of our textbooks, The Parable of the Water Tank. And he basically explains the problems that I just laid out, the tendency of the falling rate of profit, the problem of overproduction and poverty created by abundance, by using this parable of the water tank. And that there are ways of understanding that the problem with capitalism is that it holds back human productivity and creativity. And it leads to a situation where you have economic chaos because so much wealth has been created, and that doesn't make sense. And the idea is to overcome that rationally and unleash human creativity. And that's why the Soviet Union was able to rapidly industrialize and wipe out illiteracy and, you know, become an industrial superpower. And that's why China is soaring ahead, because even though China has a big market, profits are not in command. They have a central plan, and so they're able to organize the economy rationally to just continuing having growth. Look, the whole reason I got into any of this, I was a kid growing up in Ohio in the 90s, and everyone said to me, communism's failed everywhere it's ever been tried. It was just common knowledge. Every country that's ever tried to have communism, they were all poor and starving and miserable, and it's just never worked. And so I went to the library and I got myself a copy of a book by Trotsky, The Revolution Betrayed. And I thought, well, this Trotsky guy, he'll explain why the Soviet Union failed or whatever. And the first chapter of Trotsky's book, Revolution Betrayed, is called What Has Been Achieved. And it was all statistics about the Soviet Union's economic successes. And I read those statistics about how they had the world's largest power plants and the world's largest steel production. And I thought, this can't be true. This just can't be true, because everybody knows communism has just failed everywhere it's ever been tried. And so I checked those statistics and my eyes got big. And I remember thinking, I've been lied to. And then from then on, I had no interest in, and I was shocked that this big lie that, you know, socialism, planned economies just have never worked. This big lie was accepted by most of the left. Most of the communist groups think that, right? And that they would repeat that. And if you went to them and said, well, what about the Soviet Union? They'd say, oh, we want real, that's not real socialism. And that this big lie, you know, that's been promoted, that's why we don't have healthcare in this country. That's why, we don't have, you know, decent protections. It comes up in every debate. You know, it's like you say, well, geez, maybe we should pay a decent wage. Oh, can't do that. That's communism, and communism failed. And so that's why I was interested in communism to begin with. I was interested in economics and this understanding that the capitalist system is highly irrational, and with central planning, you can build things up. And that the woke left, they're not interested in that at all. And in fact, that was one of the main criticisms when my YouTube channel got going, is people say, you sound like a libertarian. You sound like a libertarian. How do I sound like a libertarian? I'm advocating the exact opposite of what they want, but I'm interested in economics. Being a leftist means you call people racist. Being a leftist means you call people homophobic and sexist, and you wave the rainbow flag and you say, I think you're a secret Nazi. You know, you scratched your nose and did a hand sign. You're secretly in the Ku Klux Klan. I've got you. Being a leftist is, it's the left. When we talk about left, right? Right and left come out of the French Revolution, right? When they created a national assembly after the king was overthrown. The people that were on the left were the most enthusiastic Jacobins, and the people that were a little more, you know, conservative, they sat on the right. That's where left and right comes from. And left has been reduced to an aesthetic. It is the aesthetic of rebellion. It is the Oedipal and libidinal impulse. That's why red is the color associated with the left. It started out, you know, the French revolutionaries would wear red caps, right? And red is the color of what? Blood, vengeance. It's also the color of sexual passion. It's also, you know, the color of anger. And basically, in order to overthrow feudalism, the emerging French capitalist class gave people in a very conservative, strict, restricting feudal society permission to unleash their impulses, permission to unleash their anger, unleash their sexual desires, let it all out. And they created an explosion that brought down feudalism in France and brought capitalism into existence. And left has been associated with that aesthetic. It is letting people get their anger out, letting people get their revenge, letting people explode, basically. And that's Trotskyism. That's the permanent revolution. And the brilliance of Stalin was that after the Russian Revolution, Stalin kind of rescued communism from that. And that if you look at, especially in the late 1930s, it was completely different. The Soviet Union was appealing to much more healthy feelings. And they're saying that we can't hold society together on the basis of this left aesthetic. And that, you know, during the Second World War, they made films about, you know, Ivan the Terrible, the great czar who united the Russian Empire. And that Stalin is very much saying this. There's a British psychoanalyst who is a thinker of the British Communist Party I really like, called Reuben Osborne. And he says the same thing. And he says, look, he says, communists, they want people to do good things, but they're appealing to people's very deviant feelings in order to do it. Whereas fascists, they're doing bad things, but they're appealing to people's healthy emotions. Loving your country is the most natural feeling ever. It's tied in with the love of one's parents. Why do they call it the motherland or the fatherland, right? And that communists have this, oh, we can't love our country, right, thing going on. Well, fascists said, we love the homeland, we love the country, and that fascists were appealing to much healthier and widespread sentiments among the population, whereas communists were appealing to people's deviance, people's desire to kill their parents and take revenge and unleash their sexual desires and all of that. And that Reuben Osborne, in his writing in the late 30s, says, if we're going to defeat fascism, we have to start appealing to people's healthy emotions. And if you look at the Communist Party conventions in the United States, they did this. They pivoted. They had big pictures of Abraham Lincoln. And they said, we are defending the American tradition of democracy against fascism. And they talked about, you know, communism is nothing but 20th century Americanism, and that the kind of the late 1930s and the World War II period, that was kind of the golden era of American communism, where Roosevelt, who was aligned with them, was the president, was creating great reforms. Stalin was aligned with the United States against fascism in World War II. And you know what we got from that was Superman. The Superman comic books came out during those years. How do you say Man of Steel in Russian? Stalin, right? And that's Superman. His first adventure was rescuing a group of striking miners from their crooked boss. And Lex Luthor is an evil technocratic capitalist who runs a big corporation. And Superman at the time was preaching against racism, which was a really big deal because Jim Crow segregation was still in effect in the United States. He was fighting the Ku Klux Klan and, you know, pushing anti-fascism, truth, justice in the American way. Superman, the ideals of the Superman comics, which they make you feel good, love of community, fighting for justice against, you know, ruthless forces that would manipulate us, not liking violence. Superman, you know, he hates violence, but he does protect the weak when he has to, right? And Superman, he's from Smallville, Kansas, from this little tiny town in Kansas. And at the time, the leader of the Communist Party in the United States was Earl Browder. And his campaign theme song for his presidential campaigns was The Man from Kansas. And they played up that he was this guy from Kansas. You look at that aesthetic of the Superman comics when they first started out. That was the communist aesthetic that was really winning. That's what Stalin kind of came up with to win the Second World War, to build the popular front. And that is what the new left was trying to take apart. And coming out of the Second World War, the new left, they couldn't stand that. One of the leaders of the Weather Underground was a guy named Jeff Jones. And he gave a speech where he said, we want to appeal to the part of every kid that loves Lex Luthor and hates Superman, right? You know, and the new left, you could call it, they were an attempt to really kind of, you know, take that that you know, Oedipal libidinal appeal and restore that and move leftism away from the kind of brilliant Soviet aesthetic that had been developed during the Popular Front years, right? And it's kind of amazing to see that. But Trotskyism was also very much an attempt to hold on to that. When Stalin repudiated Trotsky and repudiated the permanent revolution, he was saying we need socialism in one country. We need to stabilize and build up. Trotsky wanted blood and killing forever, right? And, you know, he wanted a permanent crusade to tear down the West. He was not interested in Russia. He hated the Russian peasantry. And that neoconservatism is very much the left aesthetic and the leftist mindset to serve Western imperialism, and that Trotsky had that falling out with his followers, with James Burnham in 1939 and Max Shackman and others. And eventually a layer of people that had been Trotskyists in the late 30s took that kind of mindset, that record destruction, chaos mindset, and used it to serve the Western system. And that, you know, that's where neoconservatism comes from. But it's all rooted in contempt for humanity. That's a really big part of the woke left. I mean, there's too many people in the world, overpopulation. It's a big part of neoconservatism. I quote so many times Irving Kristol, now the father of Bill Kristol of the Weekly Standard. He tells the story of how he stopped being a leftist. He got drafted into the army and he met the working class. He had written about the working class and he met the working class and he didn't like them. And he thought they were crude and idiots and rough and tough and anti-Semitic. And he said, I can't build socialism with these people. And that's how he became a conservative. It was hating Americans by going into the military. And that's what made him. He was this elitist conservative. And he hated the people that he actually met. And that's what drove him into conservatism. And that there's this kind of contempt for the people. And that Trotsky had a big ounce of that. Right. And that you read about what Lenin wrote about the Jewish bund. right? Lenin, you know, wrote about, you know, the Jewish Bund was this group of communists who said, we can't form our own, you know, we can't join the Bolsheviks. We have to have our own group, you know, for Jews, because Jews are just so special. And Lenin calls this, he says, this is the spirit of the ghetto, right? And that, you know, you can argue there's a continuity between Trotskyism and neoconservatism. It's contempt for humanity. It's the spirit of the ghetto, that the masses of people in Western countries are dangerous, bloodthirsty, you know, hateful, you know, ugly folks, and that we have to kind of rule over them and control them because they're so dangerous. Contempt for the people and anti-populism is the continuity, I would argue, between Trotskyism and neoconservatism. And the woke left is anti-populist. That's why they think populism is such a danger, even though socialism as a movement is like the definition of populism. It's rallying the masses of people to control the means of production, to have the economy serve the people, not the wealthy elite. But the idea that populism is a bad word to the woke left, that kind of, that right there, they're not really the same thing that socialism has ever been.
So to just two quick questions. One, Lenin wrote a pamphlet or a book or an essay called, one of my favorite ones is called Leftism, an Infantile Disorder. Okay. Which, I mean, because when I've read the debates between Trotsky and Stalin, they both try to position themselves as the true heir to Lenin, right? But it strikes me like, it seems like Stalin really internalized that essay from Lenin about the infantile disorder. Because, I mean, Lenin was in charge during a very rocky period, and his focus is always just pure realism. What can I do to keep this on track, to stop it all collapsing, you know, even if it means deviating a little bit here and there. We have, like, if I don't do this, things are going to collapse. Like, so one example is when he brings in the NEP, or when he's like, right, we're going to have to hire foreign managers, even if they're American, we're going to have to bring them in, because otherwise this thing is going to fall apart and all the revolution will be for nothing. So Lenin seems to me to be a pragmatist first, okay, and then like an ideologue second. Whereas reading Trotsky, he always strikes me as almost the opposite, like almost... It's the other way around. He is like an ideologue first and then a pragmatist second. But Stalin, from what I've read so far, seems to be pragmatic in the same way that Lenin was, doing what is necessary to keep the revolution alive. Something like that. Do you think that's fair?
Oh, sure. I mean, the book is Left-Wing Communism and Infantile Disorder. And in that book, he's really just talking about virtue signaling. He's saying we're trying to build a real mass movement around the world to defeat Western imperialism aligned with the Soviet Union. And that there were a bunch of people that were attracted to the Bolsheviks just because they'd had a violent revolution, right? Because they have violence, they overthrew, you know, and he's saying to them things like, run for office. You know, and they're saying, no, elections are, you know, a tool of the capitalists and we want a violent revolution. He's saying, yeah, but, you know, the only time a lot of people think about politics is during the election. So if you don't participate in the election, you're not going to reach all these people. And he says, join labor unions that you don't control. Oh, I would never join this union. It's racist. He says, go into the union and meet the workers that are in the union. Don't just set up your own little tiny little pure communist union. Go join the existing union and meet people and build a mass movement. And he even says support the Labor Party, because at the time you had like Russiagate via 1920, where they were accusing the Labor Party of being agents of Russia. And, you know, the Labor Party, they were talking about outlawing it and all this. And Lenin says, look, the average working class person in Britain is seeing the Labor Party under attack. So go join the Labor Party and try to win people there to our perspective. And he even says, you'll be supporting the Labor Party in the same way that a rope supports a hanged man, right? And that you have to build a serious movement. You have to not just virtue signal, right? And one of the main people he goes after in that pamphlet is Sylvia Pankhurst, the feminist. And Sylvia Pankhurst was saying, oh, we don't want to run in elections and all kinds of things. And it's a really important book where he kind of gives the history of the Bolshevik Party. There's also a great series of lectures that Stalin gave called The Foundations of Leninism. And it was like from around the world, all the communists from around the world would come to learn the Leninist methods, and Stalin would teach them. And it was the lectures that he gave. And in that lecture, The Foundations of Leninism, which I would encourage people to read, he says, look, we're trying to defeat the Western imperialist system. We don't care if you're a socialist. We don't care if you're left or right. And he says, we support the Emir of Afghanistan, who's this conservative monarchist. He's fighting the British Empire. We support him. We support the Egyptian merchants that are capitalists. They're fighting the British Empire. We support them. And the British Labour Party that, you know, I guess they're socialists, but they're supporting, you know, war against the Egyptians, and they're running British imperialism. They might call themselves socialist. They might, you know, say they agree with us. They're serving imperialism, so we're against them. And he makes the point, mm-hmm. Leninism is against this Western imperialist system. It's against the world being ruled by big banks and corporations in Wall Street and in London. That's what it's about. It's not about being left. It's not about being right, you know. And that one thing is, you know, we know about in the late 1930s, because fascism was like the main threat to the Soviet Union. Stalin was aligning with liberals and Roosevelt and stuff. But in the early 1930s, he was aligning with industrialists. And you talked about, you know, bringing the managers in, Henry Ford and all of that. And he said the focus was on fighting the left. And they called the Social Democrats the social fascists, and that they were the main danger. And that the communists focused, their entire focus was fighting against the Labour Party in Britain, fighting against social democrats, etc. And then it changed. And that's one thing that Trotsky is always critiquing Stalin for. He's like, oh, he zigzags. He goes one way and he goes another way. Exactly. Because, you know, the world is not the same. It's constantly changing. And what's right on Tuesday is not right on Wednesday. And what's right on Wednesday is not right on Thursday. And that the Soviet Union was trying to break the world out of Western imperialism and Western domination. And in the 20th century, we got the Soviet Union, and that gave birth to something that has gone way beyond that. And, you know, China being what it is today, the BRICS, the Islamic Revolution of Iran, you know, the Bolivarian countries, it's not communist anymore. It's not left anymore. There's a whole new world that's broken out of Western domination, this new world that's emerging. And that is a result of the Soviet Union and the Soviet Revolution. And the world is very much, the Western system is crashing and burning. We have big chunks of the world that are not going down with it. And the only future that our country, my country, America, is going to have is joining with this rising new economy. And we need to build an anti-monopoly coalition. I'm really excited about the idea of a tunnel connecting the United States to Russia via the Bering Sea. You know, and that basically, as the Western system is crashing and burning, there's going to be a layer of wealthy people who just want to make money. And that's really what the right wing has been. You mentioned this book, Divisions in the Ruling Class. There's always been a layer of wealthy people in America who just want to make money. They don't care. Well, if you want to make money, you're going to have to align with the new rising economy, and you're going to have to say goodbye to the Western world. And that layer of kind of wealthy people who just want to make money are going to have to realize that the only way that they're going to be able to push back against the old Eastern establishment, the Anglo-American establishment, the ultra monopolies that are at the top of the world, is they have to build a mass movement, and they have to align with the working class, and and they have to build a mass movement. And I think those divisions in the ruling class and the struggle between the big monopolies and the bulk of society that wants economic growth and wants things to get better, and the big monopolies that are struggling to maintain their power with degrowth, that struggle is what will give birth to a real movement at some point. And we need to build an anti-monopoly coalition. That is my belief.
In my time kind of observing politics and dissident movements and things like that, for me, foreign policy is always the tell, right? The regime, like when Meloni came in to Italy and everybody was excited, right? People on the right were excited. The press were calling her a fascist. And I said, no, she spoke at the Aspen Institute. She's friends with Tony Blair. She supports Ukraine, friendly with Israel. She's regime. That's always the tell. Now, reformer coming in, okay? Richard Tice, he's there. He's kissing the wall, supports Ukraine. And I guess this is where I'm going with my question here, because at the moment, it seems like the left are now trying to pivot to copy the right's tactics, i.e. become populist again. In Britain, we've got this figure called Zach Polanski, who's risen up for the Green Party. And in America, in fact, today, I think, or yesterday, this Mamdani has just won in New York. Both of them are being seen as like the bright new hope for the left. Polanski here, Mamdani over there. But I couldn't help but notice that unlike Jeremy Corbyn, who has always been anti-war, the project in Ukraine, obviously he's pro-Palestine, okay? Unlike him, Polanski is with NATO on the Ukraine question. And to me, it just seems like he's been put in there to muscle out the re-rise of Corbyn. And then over in America, I mean, just today, I saw Mamdani posted a picture of himself standing next to Alex Soros. And the caption, you know, was something like making the American dream come true. And I like, okay, the American dream, this is like revolutionary socialism backed by one of the world's best known billionaires. Who are these figures in your view? Polanski and Mamdani, are they the future of the left?
Well, I'm a New Yorker, and so I had to decide whether or not I would vote for Mamdani, and I will not tell. I'm keeping it a secret how I voted, because on the one hand, I certainly could tell this guy was fake. He's completely fake. But at the same time, the low IQ kind of red baiting we were getting from the right and the hysterical Zionist opposition was very obnoxious. And that's what kind of annoys me about this whole thing is it's like Venezuela. Right now, the USA is threatening all out war against a socialist, anti-imperialist country called Venezuela. Mamdani has said absolutely nothing about it and has actually gone as far as to call Maduro a dictator and reinforce the narrative that he should be overthrown. And so on the one hand, Mamdani is not taking anti-imperialist stances. On the other hand, the right are saying, oh, Mamdani is just like Maduro. No, he's not. He's trying to overthrow Maduro. And you know, like George Soros, you can talk about Alex Soros. George Soros funds regime change operations, is funding the people that are tearing apart the streets of Venezuela and, you know, rioting in the streets every time they have an election and all of that. It's like, so on the right, it's like, well, anyone who says anything slightly left-wing is secretly a communist, and that means they're working for China. And it's like, no. And on the left, it's like, oh, well, you know, he wants to give us free buses, so he must be the same. He must be, and it's like, it's frustrating. The discourse is very frustrating. And again, you know, socialism is not an employee stock ownership program, and socialism is not a welfare state. I mean, socialism is not when the government spends money. Every capitalist country, the government spends money. Socialism is a rationally organized economy, overcoming the irrationality of the market. It's when, you know, the banks, factories, and industries are rationally organized to serve public good and not the profits of a wealthy few. And I honestly think that we're probably going to see a revival of some of the quote-unquote right-wing socialism that existed in the time of Marx and Engels, right? That book I mentioned earlier, Socialism, Utopian, and Scientific, it was a polemic against a guy named Düring, a German philosopher named Düring that Engels was arguing against. It was called Anti-Düring, and then they made it like a much more concise volume called Socialism, Utopian, and Scientific. But, you know, the argument between Marx and Düring was that Marx is saying socialism is going to come into the world on the basis of class struggle. It'll be the wage worker versus his employer, the labor movement. Whereas Düring and a lot of the other socialists were saying, well, socialism will come into the world on the basis of kind of an overall interest of the nation, right? And the interest of making the nation stronger will have a powerful state that'll control the economy, and it'll be in the overall national interest. And then, you know, so, you know, Marx's movement that eventually brought us the labor movement, that evolved into what you can now call this, you know, the Labor Party in Britain, DSA, Democratic Socialists of America in America, just kind of social democracy is what came out of Marxism. Leninism was this weird, deviant interpretation of Marxism that sprung up in Russia that the Western Marxists said was a cult. They said it was more like a monastic religious order than a political group. It was like a weird sect of this guy named Lenin who had this whole theory of how to run an organization called democratic centralism, where you give the whole of your life. It was almost like a secret society, kind of like the Decembrists or the Old Believers had been in Russia, and then they had this theory that nationalism can be good. In a country that's fighting against imperialism, nationalism can be good. Marx had said, workers of the world unite. Well, they're saying, well, actually, nationalism can be good. And actually that we're not fighting against capitalism. We're fighting against imperialism, the monopolistic stage of capitalism, and that we can align with capitalists against that system, right? And that we can build, you know, coalitions with capitalists against that system. Leninism is this kind of weird spinoff that gives us the Soviet Union. And now, you know, in China, it was the bloc of four great classes, the workers, the peasants, the urban merchants, and the national capitalists. And there were millionaires in China all throughout the 1950s who never got their property seized. And they were on the side of Mao, and it was new democracy. It was like for the good of the nation. And so I feel like we may need to revisit some of the arguments that were happening in Marx and Engels' time, because, you know, Marx's whole thing is it's going to be a conflict between the workers and the capitalists. But increasingly in our society, that's an outdated way of doing things. We're moving toward a gig economy. You know, they're never going to be able to form an Uber drivers union that's like really successful. because all the, you know, the Uber drivers never see each other. And all they would have to do is, if there was an Uber strike, they would just, you know, give some kind of bonus to sign up to become an Uber driver that day. And I mean, we're moving toward a gig economy where every worker thinks they're a capitalist. And that's kind of what Javier Milei was able to win in Argentina based on, you know, the laws of Argentina treat your typical gig economy worker as if they're a small business owner and tax them. And so they have resentment against it. They don't have the labor consciousness that the left in Argentina and Peronism had been based on. They instead have this notion of, I'm a small business owner and, you know, I'm being crushed by the government. And that's why, you know, the libertarian sentiments are so strong. And that ultimately, you know, I think we're getting to the point that it's not going to be a labor struggle between employers and employees. It's going to be rather kind of a demand on the part of the population overall to have economic growth. That seems to be the basis, right? That the population overall is saying, we're getting impoverished and we're losing our living standards and our jobs. And we want a state that will invest in communities. And we'll fund communities and we'll unleash human labor power and will enable us to be productive. And I think the demand of the masses at large for a government that will push back against the degrowth agenda and the big monopolies, that's going to be the basis of a new movement. And that's not Marx and Engels. That's closer to like what Eugen Döring was saying, right? He was like a government, I think. And I think Friedrich List, the Roman Catholic anti-capitalist economist, talked about a harmony of interests. Right. And I think that we're entering a period where, you know, for the longest time in America, it's been assumed if you're at all critical of capitalism, you must be on the left. That's not historically true. Right wing anti-capitalism is a widespread thing. American right wingers don't know that. But right wing anti-capitalism certainly exists. And around the world, in Russia and in, you know, the Islamic world, it's quite popular, what you might call right wing anti-capitalism. And so I think we need to examine right wing anti-capitalism and see what can be learned from it, because a lot of what is left wing is not anti-capitalist, not anti-imperialist at all. And it's just kind of this aesthetic of rebellion kind of weaponized to serve the liberal order.
The person I've got behind us there on the backdrop is Thomas Carlyle. If I hear all of the Carlyle's books and things. Wow. And he was somebody who I know Marx and Engels, they quote him directly because he was there in Victorian London seeing the ravages of so-called laissez-faire. And what he was saying was, look, we're like a country that doesn't have a government here. Someone has to take control of the ship of state and steer it. But because, I mean, he kind of looked back to the feudal order as a reactionary, as a right winger. But what he was saying is that you need to get the captains of industry to actually take social responsibility and actually become almost like kind of quasi feudal lords in themselves. And what's interesting is that this actually started to happen. Cadbury's, who were famous for making chocolate, you know, they made a village in Bourneville. They were making and Henry Ford, who you mentioned earlier on. Now, in some ways, he was anti-union and he was bad in those sort of ways. But in other ways, he built hospitals, he provided housing, he gave a lot back. He basically built the city of Detroit. And, you know, when MAGA started getting going and people like Elon Musk were becoming like politically active, for a moment I thought, oh, maybe we may be starting to see some version of like the Carlylean world come in. Okay, we're not going to get like a workers' revolution, but we're going to get socially responsible billionaires and, you know, millionaire class actually taking an interest in the welfare of people. But interestingly, you see, I've been reading Louis Althusser again, I'm sure you're aware of. This book, What Is to Be Done, wasn't published in his lifetime. So I just started reading it, and he actually addresses this right at the start. I wasn't expecting him to talk about it. He says, look, when Ford made the motor car a mass thing, when he made it affordable for the worker, one of the convenient byproducts for the bourgeoisie, for the ruling class, for the capitalists, was that, or one of the bad things about building the Bourneville village, about building housing for your workers. You know, my mother is from a coal mining town in the Welsh Valleys. Okay, so, you know, my grandfather was a miner and his dad before him was a miner, and they were all unionized in Wales. One of the reasons that those unions were so strong is because in that housing that was built by the capitalists, they were all next to each other. They were friends. right? Their commute to work was very short, but that also meant that when they got back, they could all go to the Working Men's Club together or the various different working institutes that they had at the time. You know, they'd be down the pub. They all knew each other, so they could conspire. And actually becoming politically organized was a lot easier when they were all together. And Althusser says this actually created a huge problem for people like Henry Ford, for people, for Cadbury and so on. And so they needed to disperse the worker and make them atomized. In the way that you've talked about the Uber driver, who doesn't see himself as a worker, who's just this atomized individual, he suggests that the popularization of the motor car was used basically to make sure that all the workplace weren't in one place, that they were dispersed in different towns. This had never occurred to me, and I find it absolutely fascinating, the kind of counter-revolutionary potential of where people actually live. So maybe Elon Musk is not going to provide housing for people because of this, because quickly people would get together and unionize, you know.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because, you know, many people point out that the Chinese Communist Party has many billionaires that are members. That's true. And they say, how can these billionaires be part of the Communist Party? Well, the Chinese government's approach is it's better to have them in the Communist Party because we can control them. And the discipline that they're subjected to in the Communist Party forces them to operate their business in a way that's in line with the Communist Party's goals, right? And you see a lot of that, right? If you look at, you know, like, for example, the biggest telecommunications manufacturer in the world is Huawei Technologies. This is technically a private company, but it was set up by the Chinese military and it's subsidized by the Chinese government and the board of directors. It's like a corporation that has been set up as part of an overall agenda for the country. And that reminds me of, you know, the way Russian President Putin fixed Russia's economy after the fall of the Soviet Union was he reasserted state control with Gazprom and Rosneft, two state-controlled megacorporations. And he dug into the theories of what they call dirgism in France, right? The notion that you build a corporation that the government kind of facilitates, that kind of stabilizes the overall economy. And they call it a national champion, right? Where there's kind of a corporation that the government facilitates that kind of overall, you know, stabilizes the economy. And that's what Putin did in Russia with the two energy giants, Gazprom and Rosneft. And they basically rescued Russia from the disaster of neoliberalism and the country being auctioned off to the highest bidder and all of that by creating these giant energy corporations that brought in a lot of revenue and then using that revenue to rebuild the industrial sector, the mining sector. And now Russia's economy is quite strong as a result of that. And I think that's very, very interesting. And that, you know, In the Cold War era, there were a number of governments that were anti-communist. They were like military dictatorships that the USA allowed and facilitated to prevent the spread of communism. For example, in South Korea, Park Chung-hee was the military dictator. And Park Chung-hee, he had formerly been a communist himself. He left the Communist Party. He had a falling out with the Communist Party leaders. And he was just this military guy in South Korea. But the USA needed to stabilize South Korea and not have all of Korea go communist. And so he established this military dictatorship. And with his military dictatorship, he built a steel industry, POSCO, and he built Hyundai, and he built Samsung, and he built these gigantic corporations. And that's why South Korea's economy today is very strong. And that people will say, oh, South Korea proves that capitalism is better. It's like, it was the military. It was the government and the military that built the modern South Korean economy. And then Park Chung-hee died under mysterious circumstances. We had the Korea Gate scandal in the United States. He wanted to get his own nuclear weapons. And then the troops from the United States would have to leave. And Congress was investigating, you know, Korean influence and American politics and all of that. And then the story goes, he was having dinner with the head of the Korean CIA. And then the head of the Korean CIA shot him in the face. And then was executed by the other Korean CIA people before they could, you know, have him state his motives. And I mean, it looks like, I mean, the U.S. government and the West really didn't like Park Chung-hee because in an anti-communist way and with this kind of military Bonapartist government where he built up these kind of mega corporations to stabilize the economy, he was making South Korea strong. He was raising people up out of poverty. And it's, you know, similar. Some of these Asian tiger countries, Lee Kuan Yew is a similar story of that. You know, again, they let him build up with heavy state control, heavy military control, the economy of Singapore, but they didn't like him. And that, you know, you can interpret in the 90s, there was the crash on the Asian markets that was contrived. It was like all of a sudden, all the Western corporations very dramatically pulled their money out of the Asian markets in the 90s. It was done to kind of punish these Asian tiger countries. They didn't like them. And that George Soros, at the same time he was overthrowing communist governments, he was overthrowing these guys too, right? He was funding protests against these guys that, you know, you can't really have a stable, like, authoritarian military dictatorship unless it's economically benefiting people, right? And that these guys knew that. And that the only way they could stay in power, the USA was letting them, you know, be in power as military dictators against communism. But in order to do it, they had to hand out the goods. And the USA didn't really appreciate them handing out the goods. And like Noriega in Panama, he was an anti-communist authoritarian strongman who was handing out the goods, and the USA determined they didn't need him. They invaded and overthrew him, right? And that Marcos in the Philippines, he was an anti-communist, an authoritarian strongman, but he also talked about the debt, and he wanted to cancel the debt of third world countries. And that a lot of these kind of authoritarian Bonapartist military regimes were engaging in, I guess you could call it, non-capitalist economic development with the military. And that is an important factor that doesn't get taken into the conversation. And the standard leftist thing is, oh, these guys were just brutal dictators. But they don't acknowledge the West didn't really like them. It tolerated them, and that they had an agenda that was different than the West. And what's interesting is a lot of those guys are now in the ones that are still around are in the Chinese and Russian camp. For example, Myanmar, the government there was an anti-communist, you know, military dictatorship, but they believe in economic growth. And now they've pivoted into the Chinese camp. I mean, and that the question now is not communism versus capitalism. It's economic growth versus being under the boot heels of the Western monopolies that need degrowth to stay at the top, right? It's like we used to play King of the Mountain when I was a kid. You'd have a little hill and, like, you know, it's like they want to be at the top. They're already at the top. And so they say, now the game is over and we must stay at the top indefinitely. So human growth and human progress must end so we can stay at the top forever. And that's the Western way of doing things. They say human progress must end. And the bulk of humanity is not willing to accept this. And they are continuing to build. And you have a whole new economy that exists because of the Soviet Union, because of the anti-colonial revolutions of the 20th century. You know, I saw Putin. The last time Putin came to the United States for the UN General Assembly was in 2015. And he said that America is making the mistake of the Soviet Union. You can't export your system. And I think about that because it's like during the Cold War, it was all about communism, right? Are you with the communists or are you against them, right? And that, you know, the reason the left were the more anti-war people is left meant you were closer to the Soviet Union. That's why the Democrats were more anti-war back then. Well, now the Democrats are more pro-war. Now it's not about communism, right? It's about the West. Are you for the Western system or are you against it? And there are people against it that are Bolivarians in Latin America. There are people against it that are Shia Muslims. There's Russian nationalists and Orthodox people against it. There's, you know, socialism with Chinese characteristics and all kinds of people all over the world are saying, look, we just don't want to be part of this Western system that is mandating that we impoverish and depopulate. We just don't want that. I look at the Union of Sahel States, Ibrahim Traore, this new leader on the African continent, Burkina Faso, right? He's kind of the superstar of the African continent, and he's building and constructing, he's building fisheries. He's just building up the economy of the Union of Sahel States and of Burkina Faso. And he's quite socially conservative. I think they just recently outlawed homosexuality and stuff. It's not woke leftism, but it's also, you know, he invokes Patrice Lumumba, he invokes Tomas Sankara and Gaddafi. It's kind of this populist build up the nation economic message. And he's in line with Russia and in line with China and building kind of an anti-imperialist government in Burkina Faso. It's very interesting the way the world has developed.
Before I let you go, Caleb, I know there are some people on the left. Jackson Hinkle would be one person. I don't know what you think of him, but there was this whole idea of the MAGA communism. And, you know, there was I guess you'd call it Bannonism, right? Economic nationalism. And, you know, to some extent, people saw in, you know, Trump's tariffs and the way that Trump wanted to do like Listian kind of protectionism and things like that, you know, that they put some hopes that Trump might bring manufacturing back and do this sort of thing. Since he's come into office, he seems more imperialist or neo-imperialist to me. But yeah, how do you see that? How do you see like MAGA actually as a potential for this sort of economics, you know, either now or in the future?
Well, it's interesting. So I was always the one saying we need to talk to MAGA people because the left was defending the FBI and MAGA were opposing the FBI. And if you criticize the FBI in leftist circles, they said, oh, you're MAGA. Well, I'm not going to support the FBI. You know, if you wanted peace with Russia in left-wing circles, they accused you of being MAGA. And a lot of people in the MAGA movement were critical of the U.S. war drive against Russia. And I was saying, let's talk to MAGA people. And then this internet trend, and this happens a lot, and I've noticed this, is like, you know, I take this very seriously, what I do. I mean, I kind of live, breathe, mm-hmm. and sleep this stuff, and I have a layer of people. We're trying to carry out operations. You know, we were just, they had the day of action, No Kings, in the United States against Trump, and our team went to various No Kings rallies around the country and disrupted, shouting, hands off Venezuela. You know, one of our members interrupted Keith Ellison, and that we're constantly trying to carry out serious operations to get this done. There's a lot of people on the internet who are just screwing around. And like, you know, I was saying we need to make inroads into MAGA circles. We need to, you know, kind of, and then MAGA communism became this like silly internet thing. And of course, immediately everyone's making fun of it and attacking it. And like the last thing you would ever want to do if you were serious about that is call it MAGA communism. Anyone who's MAGA hates communism. Anyone who's communist hates MAGA. It is designed to be the most niche narrow thing. And that's something I've noticed is that I will, you know, in my organization, in our seriousness, we will develop a strategy and an orientation, and then some jokers on the internet turn it into something stupid. And that, you know, MAGA communism was never a serious attempt to build a real movement, unfortunately. But the idea behind it, you know, was something that was correct. I actually wrote a whole book. The book that you like about the counter gangs is actually a chapter from my much bigger book, Where is America Going? Marxism, MAGA, and the Coming Revolution. And this is the big book that I wrote addressing that issue. And it was funny because it's like, I joke that, you know, I kind of invented MAGA communism on the one hand. I didn't, you know, name the brand, but I had come up with the ideas. And I'm the only one who's ever really articulated MAGA communism and explained like what it might really be. And I also denounce the name. And there's a lot of people that don't take this seriously. And that's the problem with social media. And I've noticed that a lot of people say that's the only way you can stay sane. I mean, you talked about all the drama that goes on in all these circles. I mean, there's so much petty personal bullshit and infighting. The only way you can stay sane is you have to not take this seriously and just kind of view it as a job and just forget about it. Well, I do take this seriously. So because I take this seriously, you know, I have to just build a real organization and try to not see the internet as the place to go, because there's just a lot of stupid manipulation of personalities battling personalities. But yes, on the right, there are a lot of people that are against the system right now, and that during the Cold War, the true believers in the American way and the American wars and all of that were Republicans. And if you were open to questioning it, you were a Democrat. Now it's flipped. Now the Democrats are the true believers in the American system. And if you're opening to questioning it, you're in the Republican camp. And I see eventually, it'll take probably a generation, but I think the direction we're moving in is that the Republican Party being a kind of catch-all populist party, that the kind of Bernie Sanders kind of people will eventually be in the Republican Party. And the Democratic Party will just kind of be the party of the American establishment. It'll probably take a generation, because a lot of the people in the MAGA camp, they grew up during the Cold War hating communism. It was just part of the American ideology for so long, and their nostalgia, make America great again. We need to go back to those good old years, is this kind of hating socialism, believing in the free market. But give it time. I feel like a lot of the younger people that are, you know, into Nick Fuentes or into Tucker Carlson and all that, give it time. We're going to see kind of a catch-all populist party in the Republican camp. And we're going to see a defense of the establishment, you know, the cosmopolitan meritocracy, the urban middle class that is just defenders of the system. We'll see them in the Democrat Party. I got to say, you know, I went to college. I hated it. And everyone in my family always said to me, oh, you're going to love college. You're going to love college. And I believed them, right? They said, oh, you're a bookish guy. You explore different ideas. You're going to love college. I got to college and I hated it. But that's because the role of academic institutions in the West has changed. It used to be college was the place where people went to question things. Your average American said, love it or leave it. This country is the greatest system in the world. And if you don't agree with it, you should move to another country. And college, academia, was the place where people asked bigger questions, et cetera. Are these wars really necessary? Is capitalism the best way or whatever? Now it's flipped. Now your average American working class person is like, our country is going to shit. Our wages are going down. Our government's clearly working for somebody else. And college is where you go to get educated, to learn. We don't repeat right-wing conspiracy theories. And, you know, and that academia has completely flipped its role. It used to be almost the you know, they talk about in the book of Job in the Bible, you know, Satan is like an angel who tests your faith, right? It's like the troubleshooter. Academia used to be the troubleshooter of America. Now academia is the vetting process to make sure you're trusted and loyal and obedient and conforming enough to go along with the system. And, you know, we've seen that, and that academia has become a place where if you're going to get a place in this kind of cosmopolitan middle class, if you're going to be a professor, if you're going to work at one of their NGOs and nonprofits and do one of their meaningless jobs, you better be a true believer in the party line. You better not have an independent thought. And that's the role that academia now plays. It's very, very interesting. And that, again, we're seeing a complete reversal of the way politics were during the Cold War.
Well, it's been absolutely fascinating. I've kept you a bit longer than I was intending to, but it was so interesting. Where can people find you, or if they want to find out about more about your organization?
Well, my organization is called the Center for Political Innovation, CPIUSA.org. We have members all over the country. We have chapters that carry out real operations, education. We distribute books in bulk. We, you know, disrupt the No Kings rallies to say hands off Venezuela. We're always out in the streets doing things. We're having conventions. We're having an event in January. That's my organization. And if you want to find out more about me, you can visit my website, CalebMoppinBooks.net. And you can read all about my work and the stuff I do, my journalism, my international stuff. So, yeah, that's where you can find out about me, CalebMoppinBooks.net, or look up the Center for Political Innovation.
Well, fantastic. I'll just remind people you can buy all of his books there. You can buy my books as well on Amazon and so on. Pick up a course, Academic Agency, and I'll catch you next time. And we should stay in touch.
Okay. Absolutely. Yeah.
If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the Academic Agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.